Let's talk. And welcome to the program for Gary Hyland. Good morning, Gary. How are you?
G'day, Tiger. Good, thanks, mate.
Very good. Now, Gary, you are the National Director for ANTA, the Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation.
That's right.
Where are you based?
I'm based in Sydney, but I'm actually in Lismore today. I've been doing some work with the students at the Ginnaby College in at Southern Cross Uni. So I'm almost in Queensland.
Almost.
Yeah.
Now, you are a Queenslander and you've been involved in a political field for a long, long time in various capacities. What are your thoughts of the recent Queensland elections?
Well, it was a pretty stunning result. I mean, whatever your political views are, you've got to hand it to someone like Peter Beattie, who can have so many problems across a whole range of areas in the last term and yet can still have such a resounding victory on the weekend. It was a real... you'd have to say a pretty stunning result, although probably a result that no one would have doubted in the lead-up to the election.
Well, mate, when you look at it, really, he didn't have any real competition or opposition, did he?
Well, that's right. They say that oppositions don't win elections, governments don't lose them, and I guess given the problems with the opposition, it would be hard for the government to have lost that election. There were opportunities there that weren't seized upon, and... a number of gaffes during the campaign, and as a result, Peter Beattie becomes the second longest serving Premier in Queensland's history.
Yeah.
Or at least he's on his way to that anyway.
Yeah. All right. Now, your paper, These Are the Killing Times, Closing the Indigenous Life Expectancy Gap Within a Generation. Before we go into that, just tell us ANTAR's role.
Well, ANTAR has been involved with a number of other organisations to try and get governments to implement the recommendations of Tom Carmer, the Social Justice Commissioner's recent report on Aboriginal health. We've been working with Oxfam, with the Indigenous Doctors Association, with NACHO, the AMA, a whole range of organisations. And what we want to do is to get governments, including, I have to say, the newly re-elected Queensland government, to take seriously the need to put a deadline on ending the life expectancy gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And we think that until that happens, this situation, this crisis, is just going to continue going on and on and on, and governments won't meet their responsibilities and finally bring it to an end.
You're right there. Reconciliation. It's been a word that's sort of abused and used. How do you find the response from people, especially Indigenous people out there, when you say, well, look, I'm from ANTAR, Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation?
It's a mixed response. Most people I've met are appreciative of what ANTAR has done, and they support the work that we do. I think reconciliation has come to be distorted in many guises now. You hear people talk about practical reconciliation, and then on the other hand, you hear people talk about reconciliation that is really just about symbols and not about justice for Indigenous people. ANTAR sees reconciliation as not being possible without justice and not being possible without ending the inequalities in society. So I guess call it what you like. To me, reconciliation just means justice for Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people understanding the causes of injustice and wanting to work to end them.
Good one. It's a nice, concise explanation of just what reconciliation means to you, because there are, like you say, it's very distorted and so many different sorts of angles on or interpretations of what reconciliation may mean. So you've put it nicely there. Now, the address, Lane Cove Residence for Reconciliation, Lane Cove is one of the upper crust suburbs of Sydney, and they've got a reconciliation group there?
They have. They've got a very active reconciliation group. You're right to say that it's a very well-to-do sort of place on the north shore of Sydney, but we found that there's been a very active reconciliation group in that area, and they've been able to achieve a lot of really powerful things for the community. They've worked very closely with the Metropolitan Aboriginal Land Council in Redfern, and they were very successful in urging their local council to sign up to a Principles of Cooperation document with the Land Council to put in place some really positive programs for Indigenous people in that area. It's largely through the work of some very committed local people who just won't let the local leaders off the hook that they've got become a very active and very powerful voice for Indigenous justice in an area where obviously you know, not many Indigenous people live, but thankfully an area that's becoming more aware of these sorts of issues.
Okay, your paper. You spent some considerable time talking about early contact and the people, the people of the area, the Gadigal, the Cammeraygal people there. Tell us about this paper, but in particular your introduction there, where you spent some time just explaining what the situation was like in those early days.
Well, I've always I started out teaching history at James Cook Uni, and I studied under Henry Reynolds, the historian I'm sure many of your listeners would know about, and I've always been interested in history. And I've been interested in this term, the killing times, and what that means to different groups of people. Of course, to Indigenous people, it means the time when non-Indigenous people came to this country and when many, many Indigenous people were killed. And I talked about how that impacted in the early stages of Sydney and of Lane Cove, and talked about the fact that you know, the beginning of European presence in Australia was the end for so many Indigenous people. For example, the Gadigal people, who were the closest group to the new settlement of Sydney, were reduced from 50 people in 1788 to only 3 in 1790. Within 50 years of the European invasion, the more than 3,000 Aboriginal people who lived around that area in Sydney were reduced to only 300. And so I talked about some of those really horrible statistics and referred to the fact that to Indigenous people that time is called the killing times. And of course the killing times extended from 1788 and just after in Sydney right up to 1928 in the Coniston killings in the Northern Territory. And I wanted to relate those times to the times that we're living in now and ask the question, what are future generations going to think of us at a time when Indigenous people still die far too young, far too often?
Yes, well, it's certainly very appropriate, the title, The Killing Times, and the way you've presented how it relates to today, and how do people feel today?
A lot of people, Tiger, don't realise that most Indigenous people who died during the time of the invasion actually died from introduced diseases, not from massacres. There were certainly many massacres, and they were very brutal and very tragic, but the vast majority of people who died during that time actually died from diseases like smallpox, tuberculosis, influenza. And the point I was trying to make was that, in fact, it's still diseases and health problems that have long been eradicated among other parts of society that are still the greatest threat to Indigenous people today. And hence the question, are we, in fact, living in another killing times?
It's interesting you mention these diseases and stuff, because I'm not sure whether it's only Indigenous news that's reporting this this release of a book by Josephine Flood, who is stating that germ warfare never happened in this country and disease blankets were not spread around Indigenous communities. What are your thoughts on that?
I've read that book. My understanding is that the book talks about the fact that there's a theory that that the smallpox epidemic actually came down from Indonesia, what is now Indonesia, and I guess at the end of the day, everyone's got different theories on it. The bottom line is it had a devastating effect on Indigenous people, and in many parts of the country, when Europeans got to a particular area, for example, in the area that I live in now, Sydney, when the Europeans got to the Nepean River, 60 kilometres from the first area, you know, of the new settlement, more than half the Aboriginal people in that area were already dead or dying from smallpox. So I guess the academics have got various theories about it, but the bottom line is, regardless of those theories, introduced disease had a devastating effect on Indigenous people. It destroyed whole communities, so many individuals, so many families. I mean, there are journal entries from early European settlers that talk about the bays of Sydney Harbour being awash with the bodies of dead Indigenous people. And whatever the cause was, it was devastating. And the bottom line is, unfortunately, these sorts of things are still happening today when we have such huge rates of disease like diabetes, rheumatic fever, heart disease that are suffered by Indigenous people in rates far greater than those by non-Indigenous people.
Gary, some of those statistics I'm sure would be be important for our listeners to hear the up-to-date statistics on Indigenous health.
It's a pretty bleak story, I'm afraid, Tiger. It's still the case that an Aboriginal child born today will live on average 70 years less than a non-Aboriginal child. If you look at, say, the Western Australia and Northern Territory, Aboriginal babies born there are three times more likely to die than non-Aboriginal babies. We all know that the disease of trachoma that young children in Central Australia suffer from, the fact that still happens in Australia gives our country the dubious distinction of being the only developed country in the world that still has not eradicated that disease.
That's a serious indictment on this society, isn't it, on governments, past and present governments?
It's just an appalling situation, and Tom Carmer has said that it's ridiculous to think that a nation as wealthy as ours could not solve a health crisis that only affects 3% of its population. We know what to do, we just haven't got the desire, it seems, to do it.
It was 3% of the population, 3% of the mainstream white fella population that was suffering from some sort of disease. I'm sure it would have been eradicated a long time ago.
It would have been regarded as a national scandal and a major crisis, and people would have done something about it. But it seems that for people who are citizens of this country who happen to be Indigenous citizens, then people don't seem to regard it with the seriousness that it should be regarded.
Right.
You've got the... interestingly enough, after I gave this speech, I talked about the high rates of diabetes amongst Indigenous people. And I actually was contacted afterwards by Diabetes Australia, who said, very sorry to tell you, but it's a lot worse than what you said. You know, there are issues like chronic heart disease. Indigenous people are three times more likely to have that. They're nine times more likely to have chronic kidney disease, 20 times more likely to suffer from rheumatic fever. It's just a litany of horrors across the board, and it's really ripping the heart out of many Indigenous communities and many Indigenous families, and it's a real indictment that our society doesn't do more to try and stop it.
Now, Gary, considering all of that, considering that this is the only developed country in the world that still has a trachoma issue, albeit only Indigenous people... that's tongue-in-cheek, of course. Your paper, these are the killing times, closing the Indigenous life expectancy gap within a generation. How's it going to happen within a generation?
Well, the first thing that has to happen is that people need to start looking at Aboriginal health through the prism of a vision of success rather than a vision of despair. There are many, many examples right around the country of Indigenous health programs that are having remarkable success. I'll give you a couple of examples. My hometown of Townsville, they have a mums and babies program that the local Aboriginal and Islander Health Service has introduced. One of the huge problems with Indigenous health is the large numbers of Indigenous kids born with low birth weights. And if you're a low birth weight baby, you're going to have all sorts of health problems potentially throughout the rest of your life. And being born with a low birth weight puts great hurdles in front of you throughout your life. Well, in Townsville, the Aboriginal Islander Health Service has put in place a program that has significantly dropped the amount of low birth weight babies being born in that city. It's also significantly dropped the number of babies who are dying in that city. In New South Wales this year, they finally closed the immunisation gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous children, so that right now in New South Wales, Indigenous kids are getting immunised at the same rate as non-Indigenous kids. That's going to have a major impact on the life of those children as they get older. There are plenty of examples around the country of how communities are successfully tackling violence in their communities. So the great story of success, the unfortunate thing is it's patchy. We haven't put in enough resources to ensure that those really successful programs are replicated around the country. And we haven't put in as much work as we could have in primary health care, in making sure that there are enough Indigenous doctors, there are enough Indigenous nurses, there are enough facilities and programs right around the country to build on the really successful programs that are already out there.
All right. What are some of the key points in your paper?
Well, one point is the need, if we're fair dinkum about this, we have to have an Indigenous-trained health workforce. There are currently, the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association tell us there are currently 90 Indigenous doctors practising in Australia. There are around 100 Indigenous medical students, and there is one single Indigenous surgeon. What we need, if we're going to have, if we're serious about this, the AMA tells us that we don't need 90 Indigenous doctors, we actually need more than 900 Indigenous doctors in Australia. Some universities have done a really good job in training Indigenous doctors. James Cook University, Newcastle University, University of Western Australia are three that come to mind. There are many other universities out there who are lagging behind, who are very wealthy, who have large medical schools, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a single black face amongst the students there. That's just one of the things that we can do that would make a huge difference to this issue, and we've got to get people to have the will to be able to do that.
Gary, I want to keep on reflecting back to the title, These Are the Killing Times, Closing the Indigenous Life Expectancy Gap Within a Generation. Resources are required, serious resources and they commitment.
They are, Tiger, and it's crucial. And we, you know, politicians are fond of saying that there's, you know, we're spending millions of dollars, billions of dollars on Aboriginal affairs and more money isn't the answer. But that's just a myth. It's a myth designed to get these people off the hook for their lack of delivery. The bottom line is we do need the resources. We don't have the scale necessary to solve this problem. The AMA estimates and Access Economics estimates that we need an extra $460 million a year to overcome this problem. And some people might think that's a lot of money, but when you compare that to the amount of money in tax cuts that the government handed out in the last budget, it's not a lot of money at all. If you take the AMA figure, over the next 4 years, we would need $1.84 billion extra to be spent on Indigenous health. Sounds a lot, but then you look at the fact that in the same period, the Treasurer has handed out $37 billion in tax cuts to well-off people in Australia. So, you know, Aboriginal kids who are dying too early don't get enough money, but people who are already well-off get $37 billion over the next 4 years. The government says that it's proud of the fact that we've got a budget in surplus, but unfortunately Aboriginal communities will remain in deficit unless the funding priorities change. That's one of the big things that we just cannot walk away from. We have to resource Aboriginal health in a way that actually is to do with a vision of success and achievement rather than a vision of disadvantage and despair, because that's the way that it's being resourced currently.
All right. Well, the budget figures.
Well, on average, I'm trying to be very conservative here, but if you look at the fact that Indigenous people also would access some mainstream health services, experts tell us that on average for every dollar you spend on a non-Indigenous person in Australia, $1.17 is spent on an Indigenous person. Some people might think, well, that's a pretty good figure. The problem is, that would be okay if Indigenous people were only 17% sicker than everyone else. But we know that Indigenous people are actually 300% sicker. So the amount of resource allocation in no way matches the need. And if we're fair dinkum, we need to lift it up to the point where the people in most need actually get the resources that they desperately need to overcome their problems. And that's just simply not happening in Australia.
How can it happen? What's required to get this, well, to get it recognised?
Well, one thing that the governments need to do is that they need to put a deadline on this. They need to say that this has gone on for too long and that they are going to commit to ending this within a generation. Now, a generation sounds a long time, but unfortunately it's been so bad for so long that that's the amount of time it will take if governments are fair dinkum, because you need to train up more doctors. You need to overcome problems with young children now that are going to be with them into their adolescent and adult years. Tom Carmer, the Social Justice Commissioner, said that he wants governments to place a deadline to say, to make a formal commitment that they will overcome, they will close the life expectancy gap within a generation. But they also need to show how they're going to do that. We need action plans, targets, timelines, and importantly, we need the resourcing that will allow that to occur. Already, Kim Beazley, the opposition leader, has said that he would reverse some of these statistics within two terms of coming to office. That was a really important commitment. But this is so important that it should be above party politics. We'd like to see the government, John Howard, make a similar commitment. We'd also like to see all of the state governments and the territory governments make a similar commitment so that as a nation we can get behind this campaign and make a difference. We also need... some people call it a treaty, some people call it an agreement. We also need a more respectful relationship between the federal government and Indigenous people. In other countries, in other parts of the world that have overcome these sorts of problems, they've got those agreements. We still don't have one in Australia.
Gary, in measurements of time, how do you find or what do you term as a generation? Is it Indigenous generation, 40 years, 50 years, white man's generation, 80 years? Well, how do you put a time, like a number on that?
Yeah, my understanding is it's about 25 years.
Oh, right, yeah.
So we're looking at the deadline proposed by Tom Carmel was 10 years for equality of access to for health infrastructure for primary health care, and 25 years for equality in terms of life expectancy and other key determinants. So it's a pretty depressing thing to think that it would take 25 years to do this.
It's realistic.
But it's realistic and it's achievable, but it's only achievable if governments and the rest of the community are fair dinkum about it and seriously take it on board. And we've seen some signs that might be happening, but we've got a long way to go, in order for that to occur.
That is the big challenge, getting governments and mainstream Australians to actually accept that it's a serious issue, that it's crisis point, and take it on board,
and accept that it can be changed too. We're putting out a booklet in November on Indigenous health success stories, and we're actually going to be focusing on some of those really successful programs out there to give people a sense that this is achievable. There's success out there. If we're fair dinkum and we put in the resources, we can actually have massive success around the country that overcomes this problem.
Maybe we should take some time to talk about some of those successes in a little while on this program, you think?
That'd be fantastic. We're in the process of finalising this booklet, so I'll send you up a copy and we can, there's some really inspiring successes in that booklet, and there was an inspiring story just in the...
I do have a caller online. Ross, welcome to the program. How are you today?
Yeah, not too bad. Tyke, how are you?
Very well, very well. Yeah. Tell us, you've got a comment regarding that news story we've been hearing this morning about germ warfare not being practiced on Indigenous people in this country.
Yeah, in the classrooms up in the bush, in the schools during the 1950s when I was there, we were told by the teachers very definitely that the sealed jars containing the smallpox scabs, they were included in the First Fleet. There was no question about that. We were told that in the classrooms, and that was primary school.
You're saying there was some research done by Aboriginal person?
Yep, there was a Murray woman there. Well, I haven't spoken for about 10 years, but she was doing a thesis on it at Queensland University, and she was, at the time I spoke to her, she had tracked it from England to references in the journals on the First Fleet. She tracked it as the latest reference she found was it coming around Africa. It was definitely pretty definite.
Well, where would Indigenous people get the idea that it was done? I mean, sure, there would be stories. I mean, there was even smallpox songs. I think Gary Highland here, my guest now, refers to a particular, like, areas where people had songs about sickness as well, but it has been documented by white historians that it happened.
Yeah, no, even when in the journals of the first white groups that went up into our country, up in the Dawson there, they said that in the blackfellas' camps there, first thing every morning was the wailing for the dead, and that wailing for the dead was only referring to those the smallpox going through, because it went through the entire east coast. They're not sure how far west it went, but it definitely went through the whole east coast.
Mm. All right then, thank you for your call, for that information.
Yep, there was two of them. They let them loose in the mid 1790s and in the I think it was the mid 1820s.
Two runs of this smallpox in jar stuff.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah. Yeah, well, Banks and the botanist Banks and Cook, they were both also over in Canada when the smallpox blankets were given to the North American Indian there before that first fleet in here.
So it's not only Indigenous people of this country, it's happened over there in Canada.
Yeah, oh yeah. Mm. Yeah, they were both over there at that time.
All right. All right then, Ross.
Okay.
Thanks for your call.
Yep.
Have a good day. What are your thoughts on that, Gary?
Look, I agree with Ross. There's a lot of information about Indigenous groups who actually had songs about smallpox. The city of Adelaide, once again, when Europeans first got there, the missionaries got to Adelaide, the Indigenous people there had songs to try and ward off the disease of smallpox that they'd learnt from Indigenous groups further east. In Parramatta, by the time Europeans got up the Parramatta River, half of the local Darug people were already dead by smallpox. The book that you referred to by Josephine Flood talks about four smallpox epidemics that went across Australia. The last one was in the last years of the 19th century. It seemed to have started up in the Kimberley. It went to the Pilbara, through to the Northern Territory, down as far as Geraldton. There is information there about communities that were 500 strong at the beginning and were only communities of two single men at the end of it. I think the issue is not... The different theories that people have got is not so much about the fact whether or not smallpox happened in Australia. It would be impossible to deny that. It's the cause of it, and it's fair to say different historians have different theories about what caused it. But I guess the bottom line is the impact was devastating, and it just cut a swathe across, you know, Aboriginal Australia. And that same book that your caller referred to says that smallpox was to Aboriginal Australia what the Black Death was to Europe in the Middle Ages. It had that much of a shocking effect on Indigenous people.
All right. A good news story you referred to before the break. Alice, in Northern Territory, was it?
That's right. I'm not 100% sure on the community. I don't have the paper in front of me, but some of your listeners might have seen a story in The Australian yesterday, which a community that has overcome petrol sniffing, partly as a result of the rollout of Opal Fuel, the non-sniffable fuel, and partly because of that community's own initiative to overcome the scourge of petrol sniffing. And the young blokes in the community, I think they won the footy grand final on the weekend. A year ago, they were in no state to play, let alone win a grand final. And it's just yet another example of how all around Australia there are really successful things being done at that local level to overcome these health problems. The other good news about it is, of course, it shows that, at least in relation to this issue of petrol sniffing, the government has been prepared to listen. Initially, the government wasn't going to roll out Opal Fuel, but then there were campaigns mounted, there was a lot of really persuasive argument put to the government, and the health minister now has a different view on petrol sniffing and a different view on rolling out Opal Fuel. Our hope is that we'll mount the same arguments in a broader area, and that the government will actually listen to them and respond to all of the evidence put before it, and actually not just have a really strong campaign against petrol sniffing, but against Aboriginal health problems more generally. So it's good to be reminded of some of these good news stories at a time when obviously there's a lot of bleak stories out there as well.
Now, you mentioned earlier about one of the key components or foundations for this to eradicate, to close a gap with Indigenous health within a generation is to put a time frame around it. And when we're talking about time frames, we're looking next year at the 40th anniversary of the referendum, and you make a note of this, and you think that maybe could be utilised or used, focused on 40th anniversary of a referendum. What are your thoughts here?
Well, the 40th anniversary, it'll be a huge event. It was a major step forward for Indigenous people. And what better way to mark that anniversary than to putting in place another major step forward for Indigenous people? Importantly, that happened in a bipartisan way. State governments and the federal government, both sides of politics, supported it. It came about as a result of a campaign by Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And it took place during the life of a Liberal federal government. Well, we've got a Liberal federal government in place now. What better way than to mark that anniversary than for that Liberal federal government to say that we're going to make our own mark on creating a better society for Indigenous people and for non-Indigenous people? We're going to commit to this deadline. We're going to put the resources in. We're actually going to, for the first time, we're going to actually say that this is not good enough and we're going to stop it. So we hope that they'll do that next year, but they'll only do it if people get behind it and persuade them to do it. So if your listeners are interested, they could... And they want to have a look at that speech. It's on our website, www.antar.org.au, and they can learn about what things they can do to lobby their local politician to try and end this Indigenous health crisis.
Gary, I want to take a short break, but you just mentioned and commented on the referendum being a major event in this country, and from a Whitefella perspective, It certainly was. I want to ask you, do you come into contact with Indigenous people? Like, what's the Indigenous perspective on that from where you're sitting, what you've heard? Do you think it was such a major event for Indigenous people 40 years ago? We've come 40 years for this. What are your thoughts, Gary? Whitefella perspective, major event, blackfella perspective. Do you think our people would share the same sort of view? It'll be mixed out there, of course.
Yeah,
it'll be
mixed views, Tiger. Mm. I guess you're right. This is probably a bigger deal to whitefellas than it is to blackfellas. I guess at the end of the day, it's a bunch of white fellas in Canberra we've got to persuade to jump on board with Indigenous health, and it seems to me it's a useful thing to remind them of. I've heard mixed views. Certainly a lot of people I've talked to, some of the older people who were involved in that campaign, are very proud of what they achieved and feel that it did lead on to other things. Other people say, well, you know, what has it actually done? It was a symbolic act, but on the ground, it hasn't changed the lives of Indigenous people.
All valid points, really, eh? All valid points.
All valid points, and there are mixed views. And I guess my point for raising it is that if the government's looking to do something decent as part of this 40th anniversary, then maybe it could jump on board with this health campaign. And then, you know, that would make a huge difference to the lives of Indigenous people to think that we could get to the situation where an Aboriginal baby born today would live the same, could expect the same life expectancy as a non-Aboriginal baby. That would be a huge, huge turnaround, and it would make a huge difference to Indigenous people right around the country.
Most certainly. We'd be talking about my great-grandkids. I'm not all that far away, I don't think, from having some. Having my first one.
Wow.
Might be 5 years, might be the next 5 years. But that's it, mate. We're talking about my great-grandchildren being expected to live to a similar, to the same sort of time frame as non-Indigenous people. Yeah.
Yeah, I see mates of mine who are Indigenous who never really got to know their grandparents in the way that I got to know my grandmother. I mean, you know, it'd be a fantastic world where that's not the case, where, you know, my Indigenous friends' children don't have that situation that our generation had of, you know, non-Indigenous people knowing their grandparents, and too many Indigenous people not knowing who their grandparents are because they died many years before they were born.
Too many Indigenous people not being able to reach the age for a pension or their superannuation payout.
That's right. I mean, we hear about the need for home ownership, and obviously it's very important, but the bottom line is you have to live long enough to pay off a home loan.
Exactly.
And we want to have a situation where Indigenous people do that.
That's right. Gary, any other points you'd like to wind up on?
Oh, not that I can think of, Tiger. I guess the main point is it's one thing to make a speech, but we've got to have action. So if your listeners are interested and they want to do something, they can contact their local federal and state MP, remind them of the report that Commissioner Carmer put out, and ask them to get their government to commit to the deadlines. That way it won't just be all talk, it'll actually be action as well.
All right, mate. Let's hope. I think we need to try to harness the goodwill that's out there, and there is no question about the goodwill out there. But it's not a goodwill alone doesn't make changes. So, yep, organisations like yours, Indigenous media, need to encourage the harnessing of the goodwill, and let's make some change, some real change, and not just talk about it. Mate, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tiger.
You have a good day. Yep. Gary Hyland, National Director for ANTA, Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation, talking to us there. And his paper that he wrote is titled "These Are the Killing Times, Closing the Indigenous Life Expectancy Gap Within a Generation."